the reality is today police have a lot of power, and one of the few avenues by which we as citizens have some sort of a control over what government can and cannot do vis-a-vis us in terms of our liberties is the Fourth Amendment. What we've seen in the last 50 years is a steady diminishment of our Fourth Amendment rights out of a desire to zealously combat crime and out of a desire to, you know, sort of keep us safe in this public safety thing. And so we end up with this tug of war between our civil rights and liberties on one side and the desire for, you know, public safety and order on the other.
You lay out the rise of a jurisprudence of crime control under Chief Justice Warren Burger as the setup for the look at the Roberts Court. For our listeners, why choose Burger as the starting point? What was significant about that compared to earlier eras?
When you think about the Supreme Court in terms of civil liberties and civil rights and civil liberties, the Warren Court in really the 1960s, it was the last 8 years of the Warren Court, is when there was this vast expansion of civil rights. And oftentimes we talk about the rise of the criminal procedure revolution, this revolution expanding the rights of the accused, which was highly controversial. You know, you're expanding the rights of the accused at the same time that crime is increasing. And Burger is the reaction to that. We saw in 1964, the Goldwater campaign was the first one that really tried to raise these issues about law and order. But the reality, it was oftentimes masked. It was really about race, and it didn't go very far. But Richard Nixon was much more sophisticated of a politician, and he made law and order, he made the Warren Court one of his campaign issues. And really, he was also playing criticism of the Warren Courts really about the civil rights stuff. But by not talking about that, he was very successful. And so Nixon comes in and then has the unique opportunity in his first term to name 4 justices to the Supreme Court. You know, that doesn't happen very often. Jimmy Carter got none, you know.
Right.
And so he had 4 justices to the court, starting with the Chief Justice, Warren Burger, and then we have Harry Blackmun, and then Lewis F. Powell, and then William Rehnquist.
Yeah, Blackmun didn't turn out so well for Nixon, but...
Actually, on other issues, he didn't turn out very well for Nixon. On criminal procedure issues, these 4 were kind of like the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse. And together, all 4 of these individuals had very strong views about repressing crime. They were opposed to Miranda. And so the jurisprudence of crime control really, when we look at the papers of Justice Blackmun, and we see the internal dimensions and tension on the court, there was this huge push by these justices to expand crime control. And its focal point was about the exclusionary rule, the idea that if law enforcement violates your Fourth Amendment rights, any evidence from that is excluded. That was Mapp versus Ohio, which really provides us with the foundation for most of our criminal procedure law today. Without the exclusionary rule, there's not a whole lot of point to arguing this. Their desire was to limit it. And it took them from 1971 until 1983 to make a significant limitation on it, what we call the good faith exception, saying that if the cop wasn't the one who screwed up, if it was the judge who violated your rights,
The person who is entering warrants in the system,
exactly,
and the warrant expired but they didn't take it out of the system,
yeah, and then you happen to still find something else when you illegally arrest them,
it's all good.
And I always have fun teaching about that from the standpoint, wait a second, from the defendant's standpoint, your rights were still violated. Your constitutional rights were still violated, but the court didn't care. And there was a certain hypocrisy there, too. It's sort of like, judges, we won't intentionally ever screw up, you know. And so the Burger Court really was essential to understanding the Fourth Amendment today because it set the foundation. The idea of the warrant as the primary, you know, basis of the Fourth Amendment really sort of went away, and it was shifted now to reasonableness. Is it a reasonable search? Prior to the early 80s, reasonableness was defined by a warrant and probable cause. Since the mid-80s, reasonableness is defined by probable cause, which is also been watered down to be understood with what we call the totality of the circumstances. You know, sort of let's look at all the facts together. And what that does is significantly diminish the rights of the accused.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Professor Michael Gizzi of Illinois State University, who works in criminal justice sciences, about his new book, along with co-author R. Craig Curtis. You also move on to the war on drugs period, and how did things move along under Rehnquist?
If the Berger Court set the new foundation, the Rehnquist Court for those 17 years just built upon it. They just expanded the crime control model. And probably within the context of the war on drugs, they expanded the toolbox by which police can execute the war on drugs, by which they could conduct the war on drugs, primarily in the context of vehicle searches. And within the if you're stopped, you could stop someone on what we call a pretextual stop. For example,
headlight.
Headlight out, or you failed to use a turn signal properly. This happened to my son about a month ago. You failed to use a turn signal properly. You used the turn signal, but you didn't use it 100 feet before the turn. It's a pretext for a criminal investigation. You can stop them. The Supreme Court and the Rehnquist Court said that's okay. Race doesn't matter. Racial profiling, the court in the pretextual stop case, Justice Scalia said it doesn't really matter. As long as they had objective probable cause under the traffic code, every time you get in your car, you do something that violates the traffic code. It's so loosely, so broad. If you were arrested in your vehicle, they said you could search the entire passenger compartment of your car incident to that arrest. That expands it. They said you don't even have to be arrested in your vehicle. If you're the recent occupant of your vehicle, we can search it. And so you were in your car, but you're not in your car when we arrest you. But we're going to go back and search your car anyways. Again, diminishes your constitutional rights. So when we look at the Rehnquist Court, we truly see an expansion of the jurisprudence of crime control.
We are 10 years into the Roberts Court now, and your book is about the Fourth Amendment in flux. In the first 5 years, membership fairly steady. Second 5 years, we've got a bunch of new justices, some nominated by a Democrat. We've got changing technology. We've got changing personnel. We've got changing cultural moments in the United States. Is there a dominant thread about what is affecting the cases now coming out that didn't affect the cases in the first 5 years of the Roberts Court?
Yeah. From 1980 to 2010, 75% of all cases before the court on the Fourth Amendment favored the state. In the last 5 years, that dropped down to a little bit more than 50%. There was a significant change. We argued for a long time figuring out what to actually title our book, but the Fourth Amendment in flux really captures it because we saw a series of things going on in the recent years. One is two new justices who on Fourth Amendment issues are more liberal than their predecessors, Sotomayor and Kagan. Okay. We saw a third justice who's no longer on the court anymore, Justice Antonin Scalia, who passed away in February, just as our book went to page proofs. It wasn't very convenient of him. who all of a sudden, who had voted with the state on Fourth Amendment cases 80% of the time, went in a total different direction.
Yeah, why? I mean, he's an original intent kind of guy, so that's kind of hard to forecast in an era of cell phones and DNA what's going to happen with that. But why such a huge shift?
Scalia made writing the book fun in many ways because he gave us all this interesting. It took a lot of work trying to figure out what was going on inside of this justice. But in his interpretation of originalism, he had long made arguments that the Fourth Amendment should be about what he called trespass, a physical the right to be secure in your persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. To him, that meant a physical intrusion on one of those places. And so in 2012, in the GPS case, he says, when the government puts a GPS on the underside of your car, that's a trespass. Therefore, it's a search. He had wanted to make that argument, but he never did it before. And all of a sudden, he became more
And in fact, the idea of home as castle had been shrinking for a number of years, and now all of a sudden it extends to cars?
And he wasn't very consistent because of the fact in what we call the exigent circumstance cases, which would let police enter a home without a warrant, and we never let police enter a home without a warrant, nor should you. He, in every single one of those cases, ruled for the state to allow the exigent entry. And so he wasn't consistent. But all of a sudden, his case law was shifting on these areas. And we found this new sort of coalition forming of four judges. And then it would be just a question of whether or not a fifth would join. Sometimes it would be Breyer. Sometimes it would be Thomas, actually. And sometimes Kennedy. And Scalia became a really important part of the shift that was going on in the court. And of course, Scalia is a big feature on the court. He was just, you know, he was incredibly vocal, and his opinions when he would write in dissent were monumental. You know, he even in one case, he just completely attacked Justice Thomas, of all people. You know, these two guys were like buddy-buddy. They were, sometimes we argue, they shared a brain, you know, and on issues. But on these Fourth Amendment cases, Scalia was going off in a totally different direction. And then you add in these technology issues. And most Fourth Amendment cases, you had said at the beginning, are routine, right? My iPhone is not to most, you know, an iPhone or an Android smartphone is an integral part of our life today. And all of a sudden, that's not routine. The idea that police could search your cell phone, which has a lot more than just your texts.
Even Roberts got into it by noting that smartphones at the beginning of his chiefship weren't common at all, but now they're incredibly common, with everybody hauling around a big trove of private data.
Massive amount of private data. And police had been taking, at the time of the arrest, had been routinely grabbing the phone, and if the phone wasn't, you know, didn't have a security password on it, we're searching through photos, through texts, through emails, through, you know, everything. And even when it had a security device on it, they have tools which enable them to break into those phones. In political science, we talk about salience of issues, when, you know, in terms of how important an issue is to the public. Well, this was one of those issues which was salient.
So what drove this? Culture or the makeup of the court? That particular shift about warrants required for cell phones?
I think both.
Okay.
I think both. I think you saw the shift already, but the reality on the cell phone case, you know, the Riley case in 2014, the cell phone case, came 2 years after the GPS case. We use GPS all the time too, although it's very different. The idea of the GPS on my phone is sort of different than the GPS when the cops put it underneath your car to track. I think the culture played a large role in that these were issues that the court may claim not to be driven by public opinion, but they know when there's going to be big backlashes. And it's not like they decide the case entirely because of that, but they're aware. The other thing is the court works with clerks. They each have two or three law clerks who are much younger than them, who those smartphones are an important part of their lives. I wouldn't at all be surprised if they played some role in the court and sort of saying, hey, you guys need to be thinking about this.
And that depends on the justice, because some justices pay a lot of attention to their clerks, even assigning them draft writing responsibility,
yes.
And some of them don't.
Don't. The reality, when that case came up, you know, the cell phone case, the Riley case, there were lots of ways they could have gone with it. If Scalia was silent in that case, he didn't write, he didn't speak during oral argument, other than once or twice. It was very, very surprising. It was 2 hours of oral argument.
Especially since he's usually heavy on the questions.
Yes, yes. I remember listening to the recording saying, where's Scalia? Where's Scalia? And he just wasn't there. In the end, the courts, you know, the decision was this broad ruling for digital privacy, but not with a whole lot of law behind it. It's unclear where they're going with it.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about new book, The Fourth Amendment in Flux, The Roberts Court, Crime Control and Digital Privacy. That area of law is going to be further developed over the next several years. Are there indications of clarity to come?
You know, I think a lot will depend on this next presidential election in terms of the justices. That's going to have a huge impact. Will there be clarity? I think there's going to have to be because the court's going to be faced with several issues. One of those is related to the GPS stuff. Yes, now the police need to have a warrant if they're going to use GPS surveillance. But if they use what they call cell site locator information, where they use your cell phone to track you, lower courts are divided on that. And that's going to be one of the areas where they're going to have to decide. There's statutory law as well, Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and a variety of things that come into play there. The other area that's really important is what we call the third party doctrine. The idea that when you provide information to a third party, your bank, your phone company, Google, whether or not government can have access to that without a warrant.
In the phone numbers.
Phone numbers, the numbers you call. The Supreme Court in the Warren Court said you have no privacy expectation in the phone numbers you call. You have no privacy expectation of privacy in your bank records. Well, I think if you were to ask people.
But search history?
But your search history on the internet, on your browser, you know. And to be honest, for many people, if they use Google and if they don't have their settings set properly, their entire search history from the first time they used a Google account is there online. Do we have an expectation of privacy in that? I think so. In the GPS case, and again, in the 3 years since, there have been indications of a great deal of frustration with that doctrine. And Justice Sotomayor has been a large proponent. We need to revisit the third-party doctrine. They haven't done it yet. But I think it's one of those areas where I think we might see some clarity. But the Fourth Amendment really is in flux because that crime control model runs deep, okay? Almost every judge sitting on the bench today grew up, if you will, with that model. The Burger Court, we're talking the 1970s, okay? Most of their legal careers have been focused by this idea that we only exclude evidence when it's absolutely necessary. It's a last resort. And so if that foundation is still there, it makes it hard. And so we still see cases going in different directions. This continues every year, and the law isn't shifting 180 degrees in the other direction. There are cracks in that foundation, though.
Justice Sotomayor has been a big voice to limit that kind of thing. How much traction is she getting, and how is her scholarship moving the needle?
Membership of the court matters. She is making strong arguments. She is sometimes getting, you know, there'll be three or four people on her side. It really depends. The one liberal on the court, Justice Breyer, you know, who on a variety of issues is, you know, among the most liberal members of the court.
Not on this.
Not on criminal procedure issues. And I don't know why, but we refer to him as the least reliable justice when it comes to the liberal coalition. And so it's. Again, a lot will depend on changes in the next couple of years. Will there be more changes?
And this latest term that just expired, how did the Fourth Amendment fare in that?
50-50. We saw one case that was about whether or not police could draw blood in a DUIs type scenario, and they said they can do a blood alcohol test, but they can't draw blood. And it was actually Alito who ruled there. And then in another vehicle search case, even though the stop was illegal, it was okay. Justice Sotomayor had a long, stinging dissent about expanding the power of police.